This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Almacid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Almacid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almacid.com. That's A-L-M-A-S-E-D.com.
It is 6:14 on this Monday morning, March the 24th, and it seems like we waited forever for March to get here from Mardi Gras. Now it seems like it's hanging around for a while. Rain coming in between 9 and noon today. Be aware of that. And then it warms up, really. Highs of 75 today, 79 tomorrow, 80 on Wednesday, 77 Thursday, 77 Friday. And then, unfortunately, no more rain until Saturday, and I got a lot of parades scheduled for then, so we'll have to see how that plays out. Right now, it's 65 degrees, and we're joined by Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. How are you doing, Professor? Good morning.
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about ratings, and I saw a couple of different things from a couple of different people over the weekend about President Trump's approval ratings. Some say they were good, some say they were bad. Where does his approval rating stand?
Well, the first piece of advice is the same piece of advice that I will always give, which is never look at one poll, because any one poll will have the possibility of a weird sample, and you have variation in question wording. So you always look at the polls in aggregation. So right now I am looking at the polling averages at Real Clear Politics as we speak, and there's very little movement. So if you look at the president's approval rating as he came into office, the ratings were an average approval of 49.2% with a disapproval of 47.8%, very close, with the president just a little bit below 50%. He's never actually cracked 50%, not in his first term and not this term. And if you look right now, where he is right now is just the slightest decline. So he's now at an average approval of 47.9%, disapproval of 48.8%, which is very little movement. So he's a little bit underwater, but it's relatively close to when he came into office. Always look at the polls in aggregation. Never look at one poll.
So how does that compare with other presidents?
Okay, so what's happened over the last few years and decades is that everybody's really been locked into partisanship. So Democrats will always evaluate a Democratic president positively and a Republican president negatively. Republicans will evaluate a Republican president positively and a Democratic president negatively. So everybody's really locked in a range. So we actually saw both President Trump in his first term and President Biden looking very similarly with approval ratings below 50%. but never really moving outside a range. Now, if you look at previous presidents in, for example, the late 20th century, where we really have good polling data, so if you look at late 20th century and just the early 21st century, there was a lot more variation when partisanship wasn't quite locked in. So we used to see things like a rally around the flag effect, where there's some major foreign policy event and the president's approval rating just shoots up. So if you think, for example, back to 9/11, when George W. Bush's approval rating went way up over 90%, that kind of thing doesn't really happen anymore. And it's not just that we don't have those unifying foreign policy events. It's also that everybody's just so locked into partisanship that both with former President Biden and President Trump, everybody's just kind of locked in, and you have presidents sitting at approval ratings below 50%, usually above 40%, but kind of hovering in that range.
When it as it relates to the new normal, and it's either win or lose, it's either my guy or your guy or woman. Not that a woman has ever been elected, but hopefully one day one will. Is it that the new norm, or do you see that changing, Professor? I know this is just based on speculation and your experience, but have we been through cycles in the country where it's been as partisan as it is now? It's either win or lose, zero sum, right? Either my guy or your guy, and there's nothing in between. Forget policy. It's all about winning or losing. Have there been times in a country like that or not?
Well, I mean, elections are about policy, ultimately, and every election is zero sum. But as far as polarization goes, the mid-20th century was the anomalous period in American history of depolarization. And what I mean by that is that the center of the Democratic Party and the center of the Republican Party were relatively close together, ideologically speaking. If you look at where the center of gravity was in the Democratic Party and center of gravity in the Republican Party, mid-20th century, they weren't all that far apart. They could talk to each other because the ideological distance wasn't that big. There were points of agreement, but that was the weird point in American history. Throughout most of American history, the parties have been relatively far apart. Now, that means a couple of things. First of all, it means that we are in a period right now that in some ways is more normal for American history, but it also means that in principle, it's possible for American politics to depolarize. We just don't really know necessarily how to get the parties talking in let's say, more healthy ways.
And then came Elon Musk. We'll talk about him when we come back and the effect he's having on all of this. Musk, where'd that come from? You know what? I got a little bit of an allergy problem here today. 620 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with our friend Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, about President Trump and his approval ratings, latest things he's up to. And somebody texted in and said, every time I hear you talk about Elon Musk, it's like something has not happened before. Bureaucratic control over policies and the size of government has been around for a long time. The fact is most of it was never done out in the open. You may not like his style, but the need to cut government waste and fraud is a necessity. I don't know who texted this in, but for years I've been saying that the bureaucracy is out of control. I've had conversations with you, Justin, about presidents for years now trying to deal with foreign policy because they could affect that more than they could the bureaucracy that is the federal government. However, I don't think it's accurate to say we've seen something like, or I think it is accurate rather to say we've never seen anything like Elon Musk before, who is appointed by the president but unelected. And the scorch and burn and scorch, whatever you want to say, approach to it where, you know, you fire, then you hire, then you fire, then you hire, and maybe it should be more surgical than a nuclear approach. Thoughts?
So there are a couple of things going on. One is we have seen presidential appointments. We have seen some aspects of presidents trying to govern through executive orders and executive power. We have not quite seen anything like DOGE and how you kind of finished up the question there, with firing and rehiring and some of the chaotic elements of this process. That is relatively different. There is a chaotic element to this because it's not really being run with much of a, let's say, systematic analysis or grand plan. And yeah, that is different.
I saw somebody over the weekend opine that maybe it was chaos by design, but that sometimes they inadvertently got caught up in their own chaos. Accurate?
I think that's probably true. I think that there was a general goal of shrinking the government in some way. And part of the motivation is the belief that government itself is intrinsically bad, so you can just fire anyone haphazardly. And if you do that, you may find out every once in a while that you fired the person that you shouldn't have fired. So the chaos that was created was chaos created to some degree by a belief that it didn't matter who they fired, and they wound up finding out the hard way that actually it does matter who you fire.
My personal concern is I don't trust Elon Musk. I just don't, and I guess he's acting in the best interest of the government. I hope he's acting in the best interest of the government and America, but I just don't trust the guy. That's just me. When it comes to what he's saying now about Social Security is, whether you like it or not, an entitlement program, whether people like it referred to as that or not. But it is. It is one of the largest expenditures of the government, but he's kind of throwing reality into the face of politics here, and I don't think the Trump administration's liking it too much. Thoughts?
Well, if I remember correctly, he used the phrase Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Social Security is funded is that you never actually get back the money that you put in. It was never funded that way because when it was originally created, you had a bunch of retirees who were getting funded by the people paying in taxes immediately, and that has continued throughout the entire life of the program, which means anybody drawing benefits now is drawing benefits from people paying into the Social Security system
now.
Just
to be clear, Professor, to keep it accurate so people don't start texting me, we're talking about buckets of money here, that it's not your money you're getting back. But people do, according to government statistics, draw far more from Social Security than they pay in. But the caveat is, had they been entitled to or allowed to invest their own money instead of being forced to contribute to Social Security, then maybe they wouldn't. That's fair?
Well, that's another element to it. So one element to it is, if you think about the rate of return that you get on Social Security, if you simply put it into something like an S&P index fund where you're getting somewhere like 8 to 10% per year, you would get far more back than you get in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another element to it, which is that the money that you put into it is money that is immediately paid out to the current retirees, which means that it's sort of going on a constant cycle. And that means it's always on the verge of going broke.
So he's not really that far off. Is he speaking truth to the populace?
Yes, it is technically a Ponzi scheme in terms of the mechanics and the financing of the program. It is a Ponzi scheme.
Politically, nobody wants to hear that, but it is kind of true. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. We'll take a break, come back, talk about DOGE and the cuts and Social Security and what effects would that have on people and how necessary is it. 6:30, time for WWL First News. All right, some severe weather moving into the area between 9 and noon. Stay weather aware, which has become a thing to say. Monique Morrissey joins us now, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Talk about Elon Musk and his comments about Social Security, which are not perhaps inaccurate, not politically palatable. What would it look like and what would it mean for Americans? Good morning, Monique. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you. I appreciate your time. So Elon Musk said it was a Ponzi scheme, which is not a nice phrase and certainly hints at chicanery. Other people have for years described it as robbing Peter to pay Paul. So I guess it's tomatoes, tomatoes, huh?
Well, I disagree with that characterization of Social Security. Social Security is like a lot of other government programs. You know, people pay and then they get something later, or vice versa. Like you go to school and it's paid for by taxpayers, and then later on you pay taxes. So it's not any different from most government programs, is that there are different phases in your life when you're either paying in or you're taking out, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But, you know, obviously you can call it a Ponzi scheme if you have an intention of closing it down, then it's true that people who paid in aren't going to get anything out of it. But that's only if you're intending to shut it down.
So what about the economic stability of it and continuing to fund it, whether you plan to shut it down or not? Can the government afford to keep funding it? I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to ask.
Absolutely. I mean, there is an issue with Social Security's finances, but it's actually a fairly moderate one, and it's perfectly solvable. So basically, because of the baby boomers retiring, the amount that's going out has been increasing, and this is totally normal, and it was planned for. The actuaries for Social Security knew about this decades ago and put more money in the trust fund, and now we're drawing down the trust fund. And people think that drawing down the trust fund is a problem, but that's what it was there for, because Social Security really is designed to be current contributions go to current beneficiaries. That is a completely normal thing. That's the way it's always functioned. But they built up a little bit of extra savings for the baby boomers, and the baby boomers are here now. The problem is that, you know, we also need to adjust things periodically. And the last time Social Security was adjusted was 1983. So it's high time that we increase revenues into the system, because costs long term are going up about 1% of GDP. So this is manageable. It's not like the costs are going up, you know, increasingly year after year. It's like they went up and then they're going to level off, and we just need to close that shortfall.
You said drawing down trust fund. People text me and say that Congress has raided the trust fund. Are they drawing it down to pay Social Security? Are they drawing it down for other things? Tell me what's happening there.
Yeah, no, they're absolutely paying. They're drawing it down in order to pay benefits for the baby boomers. There is nothing wrong with that. So this is, you know, people who don't like Social Security, and most people like Social Security, by the way, and this is bipartisan. They're sort of ideological people who have an issue with Social Security, and then they like to say these things. But the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats love Social Security, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with drawing down the trust fund. That was what it was there for. In fact, what we should be saying is that the Social Security actuaries planned decades in advance for what they knew to be the post-war bulge of births, right? This is what happened. World War II, after World War II, a lot of babies were born. And, you know, that's a larger than usual cohort, and they planned around that. And so it's actually, you know, really, if it wasn't for the smears against Social Security, we should all be thanking the actuaries and people who work at Social Security for having seen this in advance and planned around it.
So is Social Security at risk, or if not, and you say it needs to be adjusted, do you adjust benefits, do you adjust retirement age, or do you just start collecting more from the people that are working?
Well, I mean, certainly the vast majority of Americans just want to put more revenue into the system. In fact, there's even support for expanding benefits and paying for them various ways. But let's say you don't even want to expand benefits. There's, you know, for example, there's an organization that's a bipartisan Big Tent organization called the National Academy of Social Insurance. And they recently repeated a survey they did, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago. And they just did it again. And it shows that when people are asked and they think about it, the vast, vast majority of Democrats and Republicans just want to increase revenues into the system. And this can be done by a very slow and gradual increase in the payroll tax rate. But also what's really popular is raising the maximum earnings that are taxable. So right now, if you make more than $176,000 a year, you actually don't pay Social Security taxes above that amount. And most people think that's unfair, understandably. That means Elon Musk and every, you know, they pay the same amount as a doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's and they pay a lower rate of their incomes than the average person. And so most people want to fix that. Doing away with that cap doesn't entirely fix the problem, but it gets a good chunk of it. And that's actually, one of the reasons that sort of billionaires are, you know, worried about Social Security is that they understand that this is very popular, and they don't want to pay taxes on that. That would be a big tax increase on billionaires who are currently paying very little in taxes as a share of their income. So that's what's made this, you know, sort of a political football. But one thing that's clear is that among voters, There's bipartisan support for increasing revenues into the system. And again, we're not talking about a huge increase, a very gradual increase in the payroll tax rate combined with, scrapping the cap of the taxable earnings back would be sufficient to close the shortfall.
I know I have a neighbor that I help walk him through the Social Security process, and he's recently begun to collect it, and he was ardently against Social Security until those checks started arriving. And then, Monique, once those checks started to arrive, don't touch it. Keep the government away from my Social Security. That's what he tells me all the time. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it kind of is a government program. Monique Morrissey is our guest, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. We'll talk about DOGE and waste in Social Security, what they've found, how much exists when we come back. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Monique Morrissey, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Elon Musk said that DOGE is a Ponzi scheme. Monique says, no, it really isn't. It was always designed to work the way it's working. Monique, when it comes to fraud, abuse, waste, all that stuff, has DOGE found any real waste in Social Security, or has a lot of it been, what are the facts behind the claims, I guess, what I'm trying to figure out?
Well, it's actually kind of funny if it wasn't so sad, but basically, DOGE is really a bunch of 22-year-olds running around and, you know, like who are programmers, and they don't actually understand the government program. They just understand programming, maybe. And so initially, Elon Musk and others have said stuff like, oh, there's 150-year-olds getting Social Security. And they said, oh, there's, you know, millions of dollars being sent to 11-year-olds for small business loans. And it turns out there's no basis for this. And some of these things were repeated by President Trump during his, speech to the joint Congress speech, which is sort of like the State of the Union, but for the first year. Anyhow, so all of these things, so people were like, what? No, you know, there's been a lot of studies about fraud and abuse, and there are a lot of money put towards preventing it. And how in the world could be throwing out these giant numbers, like talking about, you know, $500 billion or $1 trillion of waste? And it turns out that this was actually Wired magazine that came up with an explanation for why they were saying 150-year-olds were getting benefits, is that it turns out that the code that you use in this program, if you don't have an exact death date, looks like you're 150 years old. So, if they had even just understood a little bit of it, they would have looked and seen, are these people actually receiving benefits? And they weren't. So that's one way that they made a mistake. And again, it's one thing to make a mistake. It's another thing to double down on it. And they just, once they were found in this embarrassing error, it still gets repeated. The other error that they did, which I think is kind of funny, is that they thought these 11-year-olds were getting small business loans because they saw the code SBA. But that stands for Survivor Benefit Annuity, which means, it's the benefits you get if you're like parent as a service member or a federal government employee or somebody who's getting a pension and that person dies, then the orphan gets this annuity. It's not an SBA loan. It's not a Small Business Administration loan. It's a orphan annuity. So anyhow, again, that's what happens when you let 22-year-olds rummage through data. And, the issue isn't just that they were making stuff up and they didn't understand what was going on, is that we had people, like, there are really, really strict rules about who can rummage through this data, because SSA records include not just people's Social Security number, which is bad enough. Nobody wants that stuff leaked, but also like people's medical records, people's banking account numbers. All of this information is stored as Social Security. And, having people off-site access this, it countered every single possible precaution and rule that SSA had been doing to protect this data for years and years and years. So there are real issues about, access to the data, but also a lot of this information was just, was mistakes again by the 22-year-old who was, accessing this data off-site and didn't understand how the program worked.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Monique Morrissey, who is the senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, studies this for a living. I'm seeing the text line here. Some of you agree with what she says. Some of you disagree with what she says. This is America. Where does truth have anything to do with anything now? Nothing. Believe what you want. We'll be back in a flash. WWL. right, bad weather coming in, starting around 9 o'clock, primarily between 10 and 11. Some high winds, also rain that could, two fronts could merge and park over the area, either north or south shore. You could be talking about 2 to 3 inches of rain in 2 hours. That's from Christopher Bannon with the National Weather Service, so we'll keep you updated as to everything you need to know here on.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy!
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
WWL, we all remember what happened in Baltimore, right? When that Francis Scott Key Bridge was hit by the ship and the effects it had on traffic, not to mention vehicular traffic, not to mention maritime traffic. Well, the National Transportation Safety Board has issued a report that flagged bridges, 6 bridges in Louisiana, including the Huey P. Long, the Crescent City Connection, the Hale Boggs Bridge, the Horace Wilkinson Bridge, the Sunshine Bridge, and a Veterans Memorial Bridge. Can you imagine if something were to happen to the Crescent City Connection and or the Huey P. Long Bridge, and what that would mean for traffic? Our friend Norma Jean Matei joins us, professor of engineering at my alma mater, UNO, past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, to talk about it. How you doing, Norma Jean?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about you?
I'm good. You had a good weekend?
I had a wonderful weekend out in the yard because of the beautiful weather.
Yeah, me too, picking up oak leaves. You need any?
Actually, I'll take all you can. I make compost.
Really? Come get them. And then come back tomorrow and get some more, because I guarantee they're not done falling yet. Tell me about this report from the NTSB.
Yeah, so the NTSB hasn't issued their final report, but this update listed 68 bridges around the U.S. Mm-hmm. that possibly could have issues. And that's because, one, these bridges all predate the requirement by AASHTO to take an assessment of vulnerability of the bridge to collision and then collapse.
AASHTO?
AASHTO, the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials.
Gotcha.
So they actually put out the guidelines and specifications that we civil and structural engineers use to design things like bridges.
So is this about... Yeah. This is not about the structure of the bridge and it's standing up. It's about maritime traffic running into it or not?
This is an assessment that says, take a look. We don't know how vulnerable because it predates the requirements to do that type of check. And It actually predates the check because that check was created after the Sunshine Bridge collapse in Tampa. So these are older bridges. We never had eyeballs take a look at them. And so they're saying, hey, it's tall enough, it's old enough, and it has big enough vessels transiting underneath. So we highly recommend, they have no authority to require, but they highly recommend that the owners of those bridges do the assessments.
What happened?
Take a look at how vulnerable the bridge is.
What happened to Sunshine Bridge in Florida?
Well, it was similar to the Baltimore Bridge. It predates the Baltimore Bridge collapse, and there was an errant vessel, a freighter, that hit the bridge, and the bridge collapsed.
Wow.
So after that happened, AASHTO got together, got a committee together, and they created these guideline specs that allow a bridge owner to assess the vulnerability of their bridge design. But you can use this so that you can then redesign to make it below that bridge, below the threshold that's required. The problem with all of the, it's actually eight bridges, because we call the Crescent City Connection one bridge,
but
it's really two. And then there's one over in Calcasieu that is on the list too. So it's not on the Mississippi, but it's over in Lake Charles. So there's actually eight bridges in Louisiana that are on that list. I think all by DOTD.
All right, let me take a break. And I want to distinguish between redesign and rebuild. And how do you, what would that mean? Because it seems to me, Norma Jean, I don't know from anything, but if you look at the cost of building a bridge and how important it is to vehicular traffic and people living their lives, it would seem to me, I don't know if it's cofferdams or what you do, but the easiest thing in the world or the most sensible thing in the world would be to spend whatever money it takes to make sure that they're safe from marine traffic. But you can take me through all of that from the engineering aspect when we come back. We're talking about the National Transportation Safety Board saying, as I understand it, maybe need to look at these bridges, things like the Crescent City Connection, UEP Long, four others in the state, to make sure that you're safe from marine traffic. Norma Jean Matei, professor of engineering at UNO, past president, president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, 722 Traffic, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Norma Jean Matei, professor of engineering, my alma mater, UNO, past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. So, Norma Jean, we talked about the NTSB, and they're saying take a look at these bridges. Among those, the UEP Long and Jefferson, not Baton Rouge, and also the Crescent City Connection. So it would seem to me, when you look at the amount of chaos that would ensue if something were to happen to either the Crescent City Connection or any of the other bridges, really, or the Huey P. Long in terms of commute and traffic and the cost of repairing this bridge, it would seem like the most cost-effective, sensible thing to do would be to upgrade whatever protection you need against maritime traffic. Am I missing something here or not?
Well, first of all, we don't know if any of these bridges are above, if once the assessment's done, if the vulnerability is above the threshold. If it's below the threshold or at the threshold, you do nothing. Mm-hmm. The risk is not great enough.
Okay.
But if it's above the threshold, then you then take a look at how you can get that number below the threshold. So we have part of the calculation involves the number of large ships. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the type of waterway. So is it in a curve or is it straight? It's more risky if it's in a curve of the river. If the piers fall closer to the navigable channel, it's more risky. And then another one is just the piers. Are the piers robust enough to handle a hit of a vessel of that magnitude? And if they can handle the hit with damage but not collapse, then you may want to put some type of protection to minimize the damage, but you're surely not that vulnerable. So DOTD has to have somebody run those calculations, and it's not easy. It takes some time, you know, but I think it's a wise investment to see where these bridges are as far as their vulnerability, because the Key Bridge, they actually, in Baltimore, after the collapse, they ran the numbers, and it was well above that vulnerability threshold. So let's see where we are with these bridges to see if we're okay or not, and just how bad are they if they're not below the threshold.
Thank you, Norma Jean. Appreciate it as always. We'll take a break, come back, help you take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Right now, latest on the weather that's coming in. More with WWL First News and Dave Cohen. It is 7:44, 16 till 8 Monday morning, and the bad weather is approaching. The big concern between 10 and 11, if some showers merge, one front, one area merges with another and parks over the north or south shore, then it could lead to 2 or 3 inches of rain over a couple of hours, which could be trouble, but we'll have to watch it, and we'll let you know everything you need to know right here on WWL. Right now, we'll take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. How you doing, Mark?
Tommy, good morning. Happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday to you. Mark, I'm having a good day. My basketball bets over the weekend broke even, and that's good because I needed the money.
Retired this week?
No, I needed the money. It broke even.
Oh, okay.
Real quick, CBS News reporting. Let me mention this, since we're talking about Wall Street and business and all that steel manufacturing deal, topic of an economic event at the White House today. President Trump's going to host Governor Jeff Landry to announce a $5.8 billion steel manufacturing project in Louisiana, according to a couple of sources. Project by South Korea's Hyundai expected to create a total of 5,500 direct and indirect jobs, according to one of the sources. So we'll watch for that. So I guess good economic news for Louisiana.
That's a big deal. That's a large project. That's great that it's coming here.
It is.
They chose us.
Let's talk about Wall Street and what's going on with the market this week and everything else.
I mean, last week, and it's going to dribble over into this week, but it was a lot of good economic news, especially in the housing sector. This is actually coming out of February. So the February numbers are coming in, and those were compared against January. We had cold weather, snow down here, obviously, and it kept some of that outside work at bay. But retail sales rebounded from January. January was down over 1% just for the month. That's a big number. And retail sales came back in February, up 0.2, a little less than expectations, but still up as the year is progressing. But housing, again, was the big deal. It took center stage. So we had housing starts for February up much larger than expectations. Building permits were up. Existing home sales were up, all three. This week is going to include, while I'm on the housing idea, new home sales for February is going to be up above expectations, and pending home sales also up above expectations. So it pent-up demand, all these things came rushing in February and reporting good numbers.
That's nationally, right, Mark, just to be clear?
Nationally. Yeah. And the Builders Association is saying, even with all that, we can't build enough homes. There is a housing shortage. We're still under the – and at the time, it's going to last for a long time. How many people want to give up a 2.5% mortgage? Only if you're selling your home and moving someplace else does that mortgage go away. Otherwise, people are like prisoners in their own homes.
Let me use a timeout here.
Let me
use a timeout. So how long is this going to last? So the housing shortage, so people got a 2.5 – I just want to walk through this. They got a 2.5% mortgage. They're not about to give that up. So if they sell their house, they give that up. And they can't, nobody else can, they're not going to get a lower rate, so they're pretty much stuck where they are. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's it. And people have described it as not an insignificant number. I mean, we saw refinances go through the roof in 2020 when COVID hit. Mm-hmm. The Fed dropped rates to almost zero. 2.5 and 2.7% was routine. Fixed, 30 years. So it's like, okay, well, then I'm sitting on this for a long time. Unless I'm selling. So for people that aren't selling, that it's tied up the housing market in a significant enough way that's where these builders are coming out and the homeowners associations are coming out saying we still need more housing to be built because the normal turnover rate has been muted by this incredibly low rate. Now, you know, I bought my house in 2018 and I was refinancing it in 20. I mean, the rate cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately I sold the house because I was in motion on that. But, you know, I'm sure the people that were holding my loan were beyond excited because that would be one loan that's turning over. The money received is going to go into loaning it out again at the 6% rate. So they were ecstatic about it. But I have no intention, you know, you've been in the house for a while. I refinance in place just because the rates were so low. Mm-hmm. I had no intention to sell. I wasn't moving. I wasn't doing anything. So says so many people. And it's just I want my rate to drop and I'll keep the rest of the money. I mean, what a big deal. I mean, people are saving hundreds of dollars a month just with the refinance for the life of the loan. And if you redid it as you could for another 30 years, imagine you're in the house 10, 12, 15 years, refinanced it down and extended it for another 30. That money is good for 30 years going forward. Start counting at year 2020. So that could tie up quite a bit of real estate, and that's what, even with all the activity reported last month and going to be reported this week on additional February data, it's just tying up so much of the real estate that there's a shortage. And
so
the builders are being encouraged to build more to fill some of that shortage. Shut up. Go ahead.
No. I'm just trying to learn here. So let me look at both sides of this. On the homeowner's side, if they pay the home off, then they would have an incentive if they want a different home to sell and buy a new one. Maybe they could use the cash that they made, excluding, I guess if you put in a new home, you have to pay capital gains taxes. I don't mean to get too far in the weeds here. But
well, there's an exclusion.
What is it?
So most people wouldn't have to pay
capital
gains. Things like $500,000. I'd have to look that up.
Okay, so, but even so, would the people be able to afford to pay them the increased value of the property with the higher interest rates? So would there really be a market for that?
Trying to unpack all that.
So in other words, my house has gone up $200,000 in value. I got it paid off. So now I can sell it and make $200,000 on it. However, who could afford to buy my home at the plus $200,000 with the higher interest rates? Is there a market for that?
That's it. And a lot of people jumped on when we had some influx in the rates back in, I think, August of last year. We had a five that lit up, and we did a lot of 30-year loans at five. Those who seized on that moment, people that were waiting for one more basis point to drop, that moved away from them. Now, we're coming around to this year, and the Fed met last week, no changes, but it's starting to creep in two interest rate decreases that was previously not in the forecast. So Powell had talked about that. He's not in any hurry. That's his words. They need to see the inflation numbers. We have the Fed's inflation gauge that's set to come out this week, and it's the year over year is about 2.5%. So we'll see what they say about that. But that's good news according to Fed and according to what inflation is doing. And my point is, like we saw last summer, if the expectations start coming out, then financial institutions are going to front run that. They're going to start lowering some of their rates when they can to attract some more business. So last August, again, it started with a five. That rate crept up to like seven, and now it's in the sixes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I were talking about just a couple of weeks ago that rates were down 6 weeks in a row, and not by all that significant amount, but several basis points each week that were falling. So I think it's going to be that with two rate reductions that are planned, I mean, we might see something in the fives again, and that then going back to your example, somebody could afford that. I mean, you know, how every basis point that drops on big ticket items, it could be consequential to the purchaser.
So what happens to inflation if that happens?
Well, okay, so that's the worry. And is inflation going to come about? Not so much from the housing market, even though that's not going to be insignificant. I think people are worried about all the tariffs that are coming on. Mm-hmm. Powell came out this past week saying, okay, I understand that. I see all the tariffs coming. I see what's coming out from Washington. And I believe he picked up the term again. Remember a couple of years ago, he said, I think inflation is transitory. He said it again this time. He said, I think the tariffs will be transitory, and that's not going to have a significant or permanent increase in inflation. Well, with that, the Dow spiked up. Markets recovered. Just last week, we were saying that the Dow was down 6% year-to-date. We had some sell-offs. Well, as of this morning, it's up pre-market about 400, and it's basically regained all that it lost. So it's only down 0.4%. As of today, if it opens where it's expected to open. But it regained all that, so people were encouraged. Naturally, it continues to be a wait and see. And he reported the economy continues to expand. GDP is positive. unemployment rate is low at 4.1%. But some analysts were talking about, well, okay, if it doesn't pan out and this economy really slows, the word stagflation is coming back into our lexicon and people are starting to use it, meaning that the economy is slowing, but inflation continues to increase, even though it by small amounts. That's where stagflation was termed. I think that was back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But there's still some worry. There's still some headwinds. There's still some things that are in front. There always is. So it's just a matter of how this is going to manifest itself this week when that PCE comes. That's probably one of the biggest things that could come out this week.
We don't want any stagflation. I'm going to tell you that right now. No, sir.
You and I lived through that, and it is brutal.
That is the worst of both worlds. That is the worst of everything combined. That's like a toothache combined with syphilis. I don't know where that came from, but it's terrible. Okay. It's just awful. You don't want it.
I think you're right.
Having lived through it, I can tell you it's terrible. It's bad. Thank you, Mark. Have a good week.
Thanks so much. All right.
Very valuable information from Mark, not necessarily from me. He'll be back Friday as we help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. I didn't mean to be indelicate there, but if you live through stagflation, high interest rates and high prices, it's not good. 7:55, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL. So some rough weather this morning, should be gone by noon. And we talked to Chris Bannon with the National Weather Service earlier and said the way it was shaping up, it could set up, if these two things linked up, on the North Shore or the South Shore, it's looking like North Shore. Now, as I look at the radar here and watch these things meet up, still too early to tell, but I think the North Shore is going to get most of the heavy rain as it stands now, so be aware of that. Maybe 2 to 3 inches in a couple hours is what they told us, but we'll have to watch it and see. We'll keep you aware of everything you need to know here on WWL. It was March 19th, St. Joseph's Day. We were playing Che La Luna and eating all kind of things from the St. Joseph's Day altar and passing around Lucky Beans. But President Trump was busy meeting with oil executives in the Oval Office. A lot of CEOs and people from the American Petroleum Institute talking about the future of oil and energy in America. Eric Smith joins us now, our friend who always takes his time with me and goes slow. Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. How you doing, professor?
I'm doing fine. How are you today?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about what this meeting was all about and is the policy of the White House on board with that of either the API or the CEO oil executive people.
Well, I think it was a productive meeting, and I think that the problem is the president has two goals, and they're mutually exclusive. His first goal is he wants lower prices for gasoline because that keeps him popular with the voting public. The problem with that is that at lower prices, you can't afford to drill for the crude oil that's going to be turned into gasoline and jet fuel. So he's got to sort of make up his mind, you know, which of those is more important.
So where does that leave the oil companies? Because if I'm trying to run a big business, I don't know what to do.
They're in the middle, too, because essentially they understand what his goals are, but he is, you know, got this sort of belief that drill, baby, drill will solve all his problems, but he doesn't seem to admit to the fact that we've got a financial world that expects to see returns on their investments, and the oil companies are beholden to the finance world for financing. If they don't get it, you see what happened with the shale play a few years ago. They just stopped financing it, and it stopped producing. So it's also an issue because finance tends to be a more international market than even oil and gas is. You can have somebody making a financial decision in London or even Afghanistan, and it'll have an effect on, you know, the potential for drilling wells in East Texas.
So I'm trying to figure out what the future looks like here then.
So's everybody else.
The secretary.
I think it's, you know, I think the good thing to keep in mind is nothing happens as fast as people think. or is it as bad as people think, with the possible exception of things like Great Depressions? And I don't think we're near that yet. So I suspect that what you will see is the biggest effect on Louisiana is that we are very, very much more sensitive to exports than we used to be because of all of the shale oil and gas that we export, as well as the LNG going up. And if you start putting reciprocal tariffs on, the math on tariffs may argue for a short-term benefit, but the uncertainty that's tied to the president's mode of negotiating, which is, you know, ask for the impossible and take half of what's offered, that emotional drain and the uncertainty associated with it lasts a lot longer than the actual financial impact of the decision. So, you know, you might survive the cost of a tariff on steel or aluminum or crude oil, but at the end of the day, you don't invest in a country that does it or causes the upset. So we're going to be very dependent in Louisiana on healthy exports, and healthy exports are a function of a predictable tariff environment, and we don't know what that tariff environment is going to look like.
Energy Secretary Chris Wright saying that ultimately the president's whole economic agenda is to lower prices in the United States and grow job opportunities in the United States, and I get that, but you know, Professor, I don't know if you have a dog or not, but one of the best things you can do, you know, the best money you can spend, go to a parts store and get a piece of vacuum hose, a little small piece of vacuum hose, and tie a couple of toys together because the dogs love it. It stretches and it gives them something to tug on. And my goal is to get the toy away from Teddy, and Teddy's goal is to get it away from me, and we're pulling in opposite directions, and we can't have what we both want. And it seems like that might be what the energy policy is like here. We'll pick it up when we come back. 821, Eric Smith is our guest. I'm all for drill, baby, drill. I'm all for lower prices, but I don't know if all of that can happen at the same time. And from what I'm hearing, I don't think it can. Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, and that brings us back to the stock market and return on investment and international finance. And I'm getting dizzy. Traffic, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm looking at a story here. Trump pressured oil executives to give $1 billion to his campaign in exchange for preferential treatment for the industry, and it would seem that the quid pro quo is paying off. That from the Sierra Club. Well, apparently, it's not paying off. And somebody else texted in, Professor, and said, problem is big oil started switching to green energy, which is not efficient and left drilling and made a mistake. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think the oil companies would say they were pressured into doing it, but I think it... It's hard to say it's a mistake when the governments of the world are beating on your head. Even one of the things we're going to face here in Louisiana is people want low methane emissions related LNG in Korea and in France and in Europe. And it doesn't really matter what the U.S. wants at that point. If we're we're the world's biggest exporter of LNG, if we want to stay in the game, we've got to deliver that low carbon material, and we know how to do it, but we need the financing and we need the government cooperation to keep those projects on board. That's what I'm saying. Louisiana is an export state, and it doesn't realize it.
When you said that, the light bulb went off in my head. I think a lot of people look at this as myopic, not just Louisiana against the United States, but the United States against the world, and you can't look at it that way anymore, can you?
Not if you want to sell LNG or light crude oil. So.
And they've got the expansion going on, right? They've decided to expand the LNG plant in Plaquemines. Is that right? Phase two?
That's right. We've got multiple phases of multiple LNG plants, and Louisiana is the nexus for the world for producing LNG. We have a lot of inexpensive natural gas. One of the things people forget, Louisiana is not a big oil-producing state anymore. Louisiana produces minuscule amounts of oil, but they still rely on oil coming out of the Gulf of Mexico and oil coming out of the shale plays in Texas.
So we
have a source, but we don't have a domestic source in Louisiana. Natural gas is a different story. We have plenty of natural gas, and we use our own, but we also bring in gas from Texas and other states.
So if I'm hearing you right, the answer is not drill, baby, drill. It's change with the times and go where the world is headed and monetize it with LNG if we can? Yes,
well,
sir.
That would be my bet. Yeah. I think I understand what the president's trying to do, and I think, you know, that people will have different opinions about how he does it, but I don't think it's necessarily bad. What I think is probably everybody's a little late awakening to is the fact that China's got different plans from the U.S., and they're serious about it. They've been serious about it for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know how they can be late to that table, because late to that party, because Professor, if a dumb guy from the West Bank like me knew that years ago, I don't know. I don't know. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Have a good week.
Happy to do it. Talk to you later.
Eric Smith, Professor of at Tulane's Institute of Energy, and as the professor said, people late to the party. You're thinking about it, China having different goals. My gosh, really? Because when you saw him build those islands in the South Island Sea, South China Sea, you should have known. 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9, North Shore getting pounded now. Should last for a couple of hours. Looks like the South Shore might get some rain, but not the heaviest of it. It's still yet to play out, but the National Weather Service, Chris Bannon, earlier telling us it was likely to play out that way, either North or South Shore, and it would appear to be. The North Shore is getting their turn. Maybe it'll wash some pollen out of the air. Hopefully no street flooding, but be careful and stay tuned to WWL. We'll let you know everything you need to know. So I'm driving home Friday afternoon after having my rear end handed to me on a golf course by our GM, Dan Barron. I'll admit it. I'm a better ball striker, I think, or at least a better driving range player. He's a better golfer. But I was listening to Steve Geller and Jeff Nowak on Sports Talk on Friday afternoon, a very interesting conversation about Brandon Cooks with the Dallas Cowboys, I guess the voice of the Dallas Cowboys. Good morning, Steve Geller. How are you?
Doing all right, Tommy. Already got the pup under my desk, worried about this rain coming in.
What kind of dog is it?
He's a Labrador Beagle, very sensitive to weather.
You know what? Send me a picture of him, because I got a new dog, Teddy, and I think he's a Labrador Beagle. I have no idea what he is. He's Tractor Supply Trash that was rescued, just as I am. I'm
right.
Tractor Supply Trash. I'm not knocking him. But send me a picture, because I'd like to know. And I'll give you the tip I gave to Eric Smith, which is go to the auto parts store and get a piece of vacuum tubing. Get about 3 feet. It'll cost you $3. It's stretchy. You tie it to the toys, and man, they love that. They love it. Let's talk about Brandon Cooks. Saints love him, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, coming back to New Orleans, a place he was drafted with the 20th overall pick all the way back in 2020. So the 11-year vet, a reunion in black and gold, had a bit of a down season last year in Dallas, suffering some injuries, but has been a really productive player in this league, despite bouncing around to a bunch of teams. From New Orleans, he was traded to the New England Patriots, then going on to the Houston Texans, the LA Rams, then the Houston Texans, the Dallas Cowboys. And what's weird is, for all his time in the NFL, this is the first time he got to test free agency out. Every other time he had been traded to another team. So Saints getting some speed added to their wide receiving core. And I know a lot of folks have been a little critical about this move because he's not the biggest wide receiver, and that seems to be one of the glaring needs of this black and gold squad right now. You need that bigger, tough, physical kind of target in this offense to pair up with the likes of a Rashid Shaheed and Chris Olave.
Talk about the conversation you had with the voice of the Dallas Cowboys. What was the man's name? I didn't get it, but it was a great show that you and Jeff had Friday afternoon.
Yeah, it was Brad Sham, the voice of the Dallas Cowboys. We also talked to him. He's got a lot of great knowledge from Kellen Moore,
yep,
having his time with Dallas. But Cooks and Kellen Moore's time didn't overlap, so there's not a connection there. But like you mentioned, I just wanted to get an idea, really, how much does Cooks have left in the tank coming to New Orleans? And from what I remember here, he was younger and seemed more of a selfish player. If you recall that game against the L.A. Rams when the Saints blew him out, mm-hmm, in the regular season, and he was in the post-game locker room telling folks, closed mouths don't get fed. He was upset he wasn't getting targets, and sure enough, in that offseason, he was dealt off to the New England Patriots. But Sham talked to us about how much of a mentor that Brandon Cooks was for that Dallas Cowboys room, including for guys like a CeeDee Lamb. I'm assuming this guy's grown up in maturity over these years, and yeah, really seems to understand his role as an older player. But like I said, definitely still brings that pop as a speedster for this wide receiving group. The fact that they get an experienced guy who's also, you know, willing to help out the young guys, that's going to be instrumental on this team as well. And maybe the Saints and Kellen Moore are more stressing the speed factor than the big physical side of things.
And not just on the football field, right, in terms of being a mentor?
No, absolutely. Throughout his career, he's been very religious guy. We know his celebration, the archer, has to deal with some Bible verses, and Cooks all around, just a veteran presence, like I said, adding some speed to this wide receiver group, and will be someone to mentor the young guys on and off the field.
Let me take a break. I want to come back, talk about what your guest had to say about Kellen Moore, not that their times overlapped, Brandon Cooks, and about the way Brandon Cooks was used last year. I think he's got some stuff left in the tank. We'll see. 8:51, 9 till 9, talking to WWL Sports Director Steve Geller about the Saints' acquisition of Brandon Cooks. He has bounced around, but he's earned about $37.5 million in his career, so he's doing okay. Traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Rainy morning on the North Shore, maybe a little bit here on the South Shore eventually. Talking to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, about the reacquisition, I guess, of Brandon Cooks. Steve, he was not happy with the way he was used last year. First of all, this voice of the Dallas Cowboys guy spoke glowingly of both Brandon Cooks and Kellen Moore, and that kind of stuck out to me, considering that neither with the franchise anymore. But it seemed like this guy had a genuine like for both of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned with Kellen Moore, we're continuing to hear just about how what a great offensive mind that Moore is. And he's like, you hate to use the term genius because it's thrown around so much throughout sports, but did mention the fact that obviously we know that Moore has been around football since a kid. His dad's a high school coach, obviously, being around the practices over there and just being a quarterback growing up, going into college, and then the NFL. And his quick ascent, I guess you would say, as to the head coaching ranks due to his age, but the experience is definitely there with Kellen Moore, and expects a nice showing from him with this Saints team, but did urge, the Houdat Nation to be patient with this guy, because you do have to look at the pieces around them at the moment.
So what does the receiving core look like now as opposed to last year?
Well, right now we have Chris Olave is your number one guy. Rashid Shaheed, both of them we know got banged up last season and caused a huge downturn from that early success that we had in weeks 1 and 2. I would slot Cooks in as the number three guy then. After that, you have some names like a Bub Means, who got injured early on, the rookie last year, will likely get some play this season. Kevin Austin Jr., Cedric Wilson Jr. is a veteran presence. Dante Pettis was re-signed, and then there's also a youngster in Mason Tipton. Like I mentioned, there's no real big physical threat in this wide receiver group right now. It'll be interesting to see. Maybe they do address it in the draft. A few mock drafts have the Saints, if he's available with that 9th overall selection, getting Arizona's Tet McMillan with that pick.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate your time as always. Good luck with the puppy.
Yeah, for sure, Tommy. Take care.
You bet. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. You go back and download the Odyssey app. Well, I don't think you can use the rewind feature, but go to WWL.com as well. Click on Sports Talk. Listen to Jeff and Steve from Friday. Interesting interview with the voice of the Cowboys. We'll talk with Cynthia Lee Sheng when we come back. Well, I'm going to announce my candidacy for public office here with this promise. Why do we go to other planets? Why do we go to space? Why do we orbit when we can't even drive from here to Europe? We can't even drive from here to China. I don't know. I'm a big idea kind of guy, but I think before we go to space, we should be able to circumvent the world, our own planet, with a vehicle. All right. 9:10 now. Cynthia Lee Shang joins us, president of Jefferson Parish. Good morning, Cynthia Lee Shang. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Would you care to be my Department of Transportation secretary to put that in effect?
I love travel, and I don't like getting in the air so much, so I'm all for it.
Could build the infrastructure along the way, the gas stations, et cetera. Imagine a Buc-ee's in the middle of the Pacific between here and Hawaii.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
That's right.
Who's crazy now? Me? Let's talk about how you doing, all right?
Good. I'm doing well. Thank you.
How was the parade yesterday?
It was good. Oh, the weather was great. It was the 43rd Irish-Italian parade. That kind of closes our parade season, but everybody had a great time and big crowds, and, you know, it was really fun out there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Let's talk about water bills. What's going on with water bills?
So I think you're having me on this segment because we've been discussing this at the past couple council meetings, and look, this is a time of the year where this kind of discussion comes up, because if people in Jefferson Parish certainly can see it on their bill. In January of 2022, we started increasing the water. I keep saying water bill, but we're trying to get people used to saying a utility bill.
I said it. It's my fault.
We have. Yeah. No, I do it too. I mean, I fall into that as well. But our infrastructure is old in Jefferson Parish. And so I really asked the council back in 2021 to increase the rates so we could deliver a modern water and sewer system to our residents. It's going to take us 20 years. I'll be long out of office when we finish this. But we need to. The pipes were starting to break, and, you know, the infrastructure was getting old. And you don't want to fall behind on that because it affects all things in the parish. And so we didn't want to do such a big jump all at once. So we started doing a yearly increase. People see it on – it starts in January of every year. We go up probably about $3 a month in water, another maybe $4 a month in sewer. And then every year we do the same increase. So we're gathering steam and getting a lot of resources to do these big, big, big projects. But of course, every time of this year, people see their bill go up. And in addition to,
this year because it goes up every year at this time? Is that what I'm hearing?
It goes up in January, and like from January. And remember, we only bill in Jefferson Parish every 2 months.
Right. But let me take it.
Takes somebody to actually physically go to your house and read the meter.
Let me take a timeout here for people that don't understand. To avoid being where Orleans Parish is, you're planning ahead. You said 20 years, you'd be close to 50 by then. And
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, but you're planning ahead so that the money is being accrued now so the repairs can take place so you don't wind up with everything broken at the same time, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. No, it is. It's that things were starting to break. People accused me of making it happen, but when I was really pushing for this and trying to get our council to vote positively, which thank goodness they did, we had a water line break, a sewer line break right in front of the East Bank Regional Library. You all covered it. It was a huge, huge fountain of sewer coming up. And that example, and I'll always say it, you know, if we would have fixed it before it broke, we would have only paid, I think it was $200,000. We paid nine times the amount to fix it on an emergency basis, plus it closed the roads, plus it got into businesses. It was a disaster, right? So this stuff was going to start happening all over the parish because we're just that old. Our infrastructure is that old. So I said this needs to be done. Both systems were losing money by the time I got to be parish president, and when we did it. And so now, but of course, you know, our citizens feel the pain every, you know, and realize that their water bill, the utility bill goes up every January, and we've been, since then, the complaints increase around this time of the year through March, because this is when these bills go out, when the increase goes up every year. And of course, we run a utility billing system with about 960,000 bills a year that we put out, and there's about a 1.5% complaint rate anyway that we have to handle. And so this is the discussion that we're having on the council side about these bills, and people are concerned about the water meters, and everybody, I mean, myself, you know, you want to make sure your meter works. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, they're old meters. So if anything, the citizen gets the benefit of sort of a slower meter. But we're installing the new AMI. I think New Orleans is doing it as well. The automated advanced metering infrastructure, they're called AMI, which is the modern water meter that you can see on your phone. You have an app on your phone. It's very accurate. Wireless communication. And we're installing those now. We've started in Grand Isle and Lafitte, and we'll move up to Upper Jefferson. We'll get about 4,000 a month done. So people will start seeing those happening, and it'll take us probably 3 or 4 years to finish that work across. We have 160,000 accounts in Jefferson Parish. So hope is on the way, although that people might not like it when they get the new meter. It might be, you know, go up again because it's a very accurate read. But those were the discussions that we've been having at the council offices.
Well, it could go down. It could go down. You never know.
It could go down.
Yeah, probably not. But it
could. I think people don't realize. So first of all, and I don't know how other parishes do this, but we, on our water, we still call it a water bill. I fall into the same trap, but it really has sewer, garbage, mosquito, a safe water fee from the state, Lafreniere Park or Park Day for me, wherever you, depending on where you live. And look, Tommy, it's a very deceptive, and people still think of it as a water. I swear I do it myself. Mm-hmm. But I looked at my $108 bill one month. I got a $108 bill.
2 months, though, right?
2 months. Yeah. 2 months. Okay, I get a $108 bill. And I bring that water component down to a monthly basis. It's $12.62. So that's how deceptive it is. But you think water, the bill used to say water. Mm-hmm. I sit down, pay my monthly bills. I think of it as a monthly bill because it's in my routine as a monthly bill. But when you really do the math on it, we still, even with the increases, have very, very cheap water rates. Now, if you have a leak, like a toilet leak, mm-hmm. or something like that, your bill is going to go up exponentially. A leaky faucet will use up 20 gallons of water a day. Before I go out of town, I go around my whole house and make sure none of my toilets are on. You know, sometimes the handle gets broken and they start running. That will really increase your bill. And that's where a lot of the complaints come from.
You're the parish president of Jefferson Parish. Is your testimony, Miss Lee Sheng, that you go around to every toilet in your house and make sure that the valve is off before you leave the door of the house?
No. I don't turn the valve off. No.
Okay. What do you
do? I just make sure the toilet's silent. That's
okay.
All.
Right.
It's not running.
All right. Continue, please. You're under oath. Continue.
So, look, that's what it is. So people can control their water usage, obviously. So this is something that they can control. And then when we see we have really high bills, if we see that there is a problem, we already do this. We go put a door hanger on your door. You know, if your bill is like, you know, like double the use that you would, and we put a door hanger on your door, we take a picture of your meter, and we notify you, you know, check your house, you may have a leak. We're noticing very high water usage. Mm-hmm. So, again, these are the conversations we're having about how to deal with the complaints of the people that still have the old meters.
Well,
but look, we're bringing...
Go ahead.
Well,
I was just going to say, if you have a tankless water heater, save yourself a trip because you have no idea how long you're staying in that shower. I know because I have one.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. But
you do too.
Mine, you use up more water to get it hot, right? You're kind of, for mine,
right.
it takes a while,
and then you stay in there a long time because you don't run out of hot water.
Yes.
So go
That's
ahead and finish.
Right.
Tell me about bills and if somebody thinks they have the bill is too high. Because the good thing about the smart meters is that they'll be able to monitor this with an app, and they'll be able to see daily what they use, right?
You can see daily. You can pay bills. You can notice a spike very quickly. You know, you don't have to wait for your bill to come in the next weeks to see it high. You're catching it quickly. But we've tried to get we still have a phone-based system. We've tried to do a lot of things over the past years. We've hired more call takers. We've changed those positions, changed the hours, made it more appealing for people to get those jobs. Move to MoneyGram and CheckFree for people to pay their bills. You know, change the messaging tree. We're still looking at that. We did a callback feature. So we're doing whatever we can to get that complaint line down. And look, during COVID, you know, it was an hour wait. It's terrible. It was an hour wait. We've got it down to maybe between 1 and 15 minutes, depending on the time of day and depending on, you know, what the week looks like. And we're still working on that. We're still going to hire up. I've told them to hire even more people and really put those call takers on the line. So I think if we can get that call time down, the council offices won't get as many complaints, and we'll really solve the problem right where it is. You know, the resources we have, we want to keep it on trying to manage the complaints that we get. And so that's a lot of the discussions. But look, I say all this, and we're going through the pains of having to pay it, but we're bringing you a new water lab over by Jefferson Highway, a completely new state-of-the-art water lab. The intake at the river is all new. We're going to have a new water plant there. Again, the meters in every household, pipe replacement throughout the parish. You can see our water towers. We have 11 water towers. We're revamping all of those. So really, really water projects and sewer projects through for the next 20 years, this is what this is buying us. So it's difficult, but it's an investment in ourselves. It's an investment in our community. It keeps your property values high. It's good for business. And that's why I was such a big advocate for doing it, even though who wants to be a politician and raise everybody's rates? But right. This is very, very important to the parish.
You tampered with the Jefferson Parish Recreation Department, too, so there's no help.
I did.
900,000 bills a year, a complaint rate of 1.5%, which goes to show you the squeaky wheel gets a grease. So really, 1.5% is not bad for 900,000. Scott Walker, who I know from when he was 7 years old, having worked with his dad, I know his mom, at-large council member running for parish president in 2027, talking about taking a picture of every meter. I don't know what that would help. Would it help anything?
Well, I think what we're what we've said is, look, the resources we have, let's please put it on the 1.5% and let's make a difference there. If you mm-hmm. touch every meter, and the old meters when we're in the midst of replacing it, we think, there is a different way. So, kudos to him for bringing up the conversation and let's talk about it. But no, we would not want to be in that position to do that, to touch every meter. That would be very difficult for us. And we've talked to him about that.
But
the conversations are still going on.
Is that about taking a picture or about reading the meter? Because the meter's red. It's just additionally taking a picture. I'm confused about that.
I think, there was discussion. He wanted us to look at potentially taking a picture of every meter and that to do that, to make sure we have a contract to do it, mm-hmm. To make sure, he was getting complaints that the meter's not being read.
I get you. Okay.
Not being read.
Right.
Or there's mud on it. Mm-hmm. And look, I'm not saying there couldn't be an employee who's just, dialing it in and not doing the work. Of course, we're all humans and that happens in anything, but we don't think that's going on a widespread basis. And so I think he was discussing that as a check to make sure. But if there's any problem with the water bill, we go out. We don't leave it to our contractor. Our water department goes out and takes a picture of the meter. So, we adjust bills. If we think something's wrong, we quickly adjust it even before the complaint comes in. So, because we look at the 200% usage already. We look at those ourselves and see if there's something wrong on our end.
You've never dialed it into your life.
We'll still continue.
You've never dialed it in your life, have you? No, you haven't. I know you. You haven't. You've never done that. Some people
I
do,
like
but
the
not
operations.
You.
I like getting involved. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you.
If anything, you're the lady that checks the toilets before you leave. Tell me you're dialing it
do.
In. Come on.
My what suggestion else? To everyone, check your toilet before you go out of town.
What else
it really
going?
Will.
Go ahead.
Really will bring up your bill.
Tell me
yeah.
about
so
what
we're
else
really
is going
busy.
On Jefferson Parish.
Had a great year. We had a bicentennial park to park where they ran from LaSalle to Lafreniere. We had the senior expo on Friday, and you mentioned the Irish Italian parade. So it was a busy, busy last week. And this week we have a J-Paws, our animal shelter, mm-hmm. Pet Fest at Lafreniere Park on Sunday from 11 to 3. You can come out. You get free microchipping for your pet and pet adoptions and rabies vaccines, all that kind of stuff.
When is that?
We also have a
Saturday
career.
Or Sunday?
That's Sunday from 11 to 3.
Good weather should be clear.
And then Friday, for anybody looking for a job, we have a career expo at the Delgado River City campus on Friday from 10 to 2. So it's busy. We're still celebrating our bicentennial year all year this year. So lots of fun things.
How's the project on lighting the UEP Long Bridge coming?
I'm not sure. we've discussed that since you brought
that's
that up.
That's your legacy. That's your legacy.
You've got that discussion
all
going
right, that's
on.
Your
very
legacy.
Expensive. I do know that.
I know that,
very
but you'll put the numbers together. Get Newell to help you. Get Newell to help you rattle some chains, put some money together, and then we'll have the UAP Long lit up, and that'll be your legacy. Thank you. Anything
it
else?
It would be beautiful.
It would be
beautiful.
Anything else?
Yes. No, that's it.
Pleasure talking to you as always, Cynthia Lee Sheng, Jefferson Parish President. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Isaac Toops, chef at Toops Meadery, about the great crawfish debate. Does seasoning go in the boil or on the crawfish? 504-260-1870. We'll also talk about some of the stuff he does helping feed families in need and how this great debate got started. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. 9:32, it would appear as though we're fixing to get our rain on the South Shore and the West Bank because they got a lot of gray clouds hovering over the area, so be aware of that. The good news is it should move pretty quickly, and we should be through with it by noon, they're saying, maybe 1 o'clock, and hopefully no heavy rain that causes any kind of street flooding or anything like that. North Shore already got their turn. We're getting ready to talk to Isaac Toops, who is a chef at Toops Meadery and also does a lot of good work in the community. How you doing, Isaac?
Doing great this morning. How are you, man?
I'm all right, sir. Let's talk about this great crawfish controversy before we get to the good work that you guys do. What's going on with this?
Just a good, friendly argument. I love poking people online. Everybody tends to have a good time. There are always people who get a little upset about different ways to cook things, different ways to cook gumbo, different ways to cook fried chicken, and, of course, different ways to cook crawfish. I grew up using the Lafayette method, and, of course, I'm always going to prefer that method. There's nothing wrong with the New Orleans method. I just love getting people, excited and fired up about the different methods to make. It's all in good fun, but, growing up, the Lafayette method is the ice chest method. I was talking to Donald Link about this in detail, and we prefer that method where after you cook the crawfish, you cook them very briefly in water, and then you dump them in the ice chest, and you layer seasoning and then lemon juice and vinegar over them, and you shake those, and you let them steam for 20 minutes, and the crawfish come out cooked perfectly every time and seasoned just great. Whereas the New Orleans method, you leave them in the water after they're cooked, and you let them soak. And sometimes people let them soak for hours. And I think they come out a little overcooked. That being said, I eat New Orleans style crawfish all the time. And I love them both ways. But when I cook them at the house, it's got to be that Cajun Lafayette method.
See, I wanted to ask you about that because my kid lives in North Louisiana in Ruston and doesn't like the way they cook them because I think it's the method that you're talking about. I've lived here all my life. I had no idea that boiling them like we do is just a New Orleans thing. In Lafayette, I started to say Lafayette, but I said like you did, Lafayette, they boil them in just salt water or seasoned water and then do the ice chest thing? Take me through that, Scott.
Yeah, so when you're boiling crawfish in the water, they're not picking up any seasoning. Nothing's penetrating them.
Just parboiling. That's all you're doing.
Yeah, so you know, I still season the water, but I don't only season the water for the vegetables. Mm-hmm. So your corn, your potatoes, and everything, your artichokes, your mushrooms, so they're going to pick up that flavor in the water, just like you would salt your water for blanching your green beans in your fine dining restaurant. So when you're blanching in your water, they're not picking up any seasoning whatsoever, the crawfish that they are. So when I season the water, I do that. Again, I just do it for the vegetables. Mm-hmm. But when they go in the ice chest, they start to cool down. So anything you have in the ice chest, being that good seasoning, the lemon juice or the vinegar, they're going to start to suck it up due to thermodynamics.
Ah,
so when you're cooking things, you heat them up, they expand. But when they start to cool down, they start to shrink. And they will absorb any liquid and any seasoning they have that are surrounding them, hence that method.
Osmosis almost, right? For you. Osmosis, I think, is what it is or not?
Osmosis? Sure. Let's
go with that.
The end of my scientific career right there.
Probably not, but I understand what you're saying about the heat going to the cold attracting the heat, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I had no idea. Is that the way they do it around Louisiana, Isaac?
That's the way they do it around Louisiana.
Let me correct it. Are there more than one way to do it? Wait, let me. My head's going messy
here. I'm going to tell you, my father taught me that method years ago, and even he's changed his method. And I don't know a Cajun, and I don't know a New Orleanian that boils crawfish the same exact way. So mm-hmm. Everybody's going to have slightly different techniques, slightly different ingredients, slightly different cooking times, and you know what? They're all good.
Somebody said it's messy to do it your way, but eating crawfish is messy. I don't know when I've ever had crawfish where it wasn't running down my arms.
Yeah. Anytime you're eating crawfish, I always tell people, like, wear a shirt you don't like. When's the last time you ate crawfish that wasn't messy? Yeah, good point.
So other than those two types, and somebody else wanted to know about the Lafayette method getting all over your fingers, does it make it too spicy or not?
No, not at all. I mean, that's all dependent on how much seasoning you put on, how much heat you want to put in there. That's completely dependent.
And what are you putting on it, Isaac? Are you putting the traditional crawfish boil stuff, liquid, or the shake of powder stuff, or what?
I use no liquid boil. I don't believe in liquid boil. I don't like the way it tastes.
Okay.
I make my own with equal parts lemon, lime, and white wine vinegar. Okay. Just something a little dorky I do. Also, I tend to make my own spice blend. However, I've been known to be lazy and buy it. I like Zatarain's Pearl Boil. That's not an endorsement. I don't get paid to say that.
No, I understand.
I just love Zatarain's Pearl Boil. I'll go on the record with that.
So let me ask you one more time about the different ways in Louisiana. Are there two ways to cook it, or are there more than two ways to cook crawfish?
Oh, there are more than two ways. I even read in Denmark they boil them and they soak them in lemon juice and dill, kind of cocktail shrimp crawfish.
Hmm.
And I've always wanted to try that method. So for every Cajun man and for every New Orleans man and woman, there's going to be slightly different ways. And a lot of people do them a little bit of a combination. I've seen every which way to cook crawfish, and they're almost all good. So the moral of the story is, cook them how you like them. Just eat them.
There you go. I love your story. Everybody's got a story, Isaac. And I want to hear a little bit about yours. You've been named a James Beard Best Chef of the South semifinalist and finalist, and earned some other pretty notable accolades. Tell me how you got into cooking, and where were you born and raised? How did you know you wanted to be a chef, et cetera?
Well, born and raised in Rain, Louisiana, you know.
Frog capital of the world, isn't it?
Yeah, frog capital of the world. You got it. And, you know, I've been cooking since I could see a skillet, literally. You know, my mother and father, brothers and sisters, aunt and uncles, grandparents, everybody cooks. And it's just the way of the Toop's life. We talk about dinner at lunch, and we talk about what we're going to eat on the weekend on Monday. And I caught the bug early. But I never really put the two and two together to do it professionally.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I've been cooking my whole life, cooking professionally wasn't really something I thought of. So after job hopping around my college try, I worked at a printing press. I worked at a TV station. And I said one day, like, hey, let me go try cooking. I mean, just off the cuff, let me go try cooking. And within a week of cooking at a little local spot, I fell in love with it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is it. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to become a chef. I want to get a cookbook. I want to have a restaurant and all this. And this is 1 week into cooking at a restaurant in Lafayette. Then I got the bug, so I moved to New Orleans to kind of pursue my culinary career and worked for Emeril Lagasse for 10 years. And really just kind of, I put my head down and I cooked and I paid attention and I didn't do too much partying. I did a little partying, but I really just kind of like really honed the craft and really kind of dial it in. And it's just a love of the art, love of the game. And I love to cook. I love to eat. And I love being a dork about it. And I love finding different things to cook and different ways to cook. So really just kind of a passion project, guys. And, you know, opened up a restaurant 13 years ago, and I said, "Waha! Now I'm the chef, and now I'm the owner. I can do whatever I want."
Well, you're doing very well.
Oh my God, I can do whatever I want. That's scary, you know?
No, but it's good. You're doing a lot of good for the community, too. We'll talk about that when we get back. We're talking to Isaac Toops, chef at Toops Meadery, owner of Toops Meadery. They got the Toops Family Foundation. Do a lot of good with that. But somebody texted in. You can answer this when we come back. Should crawfish be purged before boiling? I'd like to know when we return. We're talking to Chef Isaac Toops over at Toops Meadery, 941, 19 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 947, 13 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Talking to Isaac Toops. Isaac Toops, chef over at Toops Meadery on Carrollton Avenue. And you can just Google Toops Meadery, find out all about them. We're going to talk about the Toops family and mission and what they do, Toops family meal. What's your favorite thing on the menu, Isaac? I'm just curious.
Oh, right now, I really like the venison. The venison setup, I brought that back from Top Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a caramelized onion barley. It's got a raspberry mustard on it and a really good roasted garlic puree. It's probably one of my favorite things on the menu right now. But the cracklings and the boudin can't be beat either.
Let's talk about the purge question. You purge crawfish or not?
Of course, but that's a two-tiered answer, and I'll start with the most basic one. If you ever get a sack of crawfish and you just throw them in the water, that's a lot of mud just on the outside of the crawfish. So you got to at least dunk them in several changes of water. I hose them down with the hose. I really get agitated with a stick or with the hands just to stir them up. And I change that water out until the water's clear. And that's just getting the mud off the outside of the crawfish.
Right there with you, Chef. That's what I do. I don't purge them with salt or anything like that. All I do is wash them off a couple of times, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, and then they're ready to go.
And that's really all I do either. LSU came out with a study that said adding salt water doesn't really do a whole lot of things. I will say that Hawk's Crawfish over there in Rain, Louisiana, they purge their crawfish for a couple of days in these giant aquifer tanks. Mm-hmm. And I will say that they put out some of the best crawfish in all of the land. So there might be something to it, but I don't have the time or the presence and the place to purge my crawfish for 3 days.
Do you eat the black thing, Chef?
No, unless the crawfish are really small.
Yeah.
If they're really small, I'll throw them back. But if they're anything, if they're worth picking out, I will pick the black thing out.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I had biology in high school. Tell me about the Toops family meal, will you please? Because I admire you. First of all, I'm just a fan of yours. I admire a guy that follows his passion, puts his money where his passion is, and that's what you dig. Because it takes some, you know what, to start your own restaurant and follow your passion, which you did, and now you're giving back to the community. Tell me about Toops family meal, please.
The Toops family meal, you know, started really just kind of a knee-jerk reaction during the pandemic. So all those years back when, during the gosh darn pandemic, you know, we had to lay a couple employees off because the restaurant shut down completely. But we kept our managers, and we said, look, we're going to keep the managers and the few hourly employees. We said, hey, look, come back every day during our family meal, which is just our word for staff meal. We have a staff meal for the lunch service. We have a staff meal for the dinner service. We cook around 8 to 10 employees every day. It's just kind of our normal thing. You get a meal at the restaurant. And I said, hey, look, I'll make a little bit extra. So you come in every day. We'll check in on you. And you can have a meal twice a day. So at least you're eating. Well, they called me up and said, Chef, thank you for the meal. But my roommate, he got fired and we don't have any food. Well, I said, well, we'll bring him over. And instead of 10 family meals, I'll cook 15. No big deal. Well, the next day it was 20. The day after that it was 40, and that snowballed into feeding 300 people every day. And we got word of mouth out and social media out. I just heard people were hungry, and I said, "To heck with that! No, absolutely not. We're going to feed the people." So I just started cooking, and luckily my beautiful wife, who's way a lot more intelligent than I am, said, "Well, we got to get this crowdfunded." And I went, oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea because we'd have run out of food pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But we had the support of all of our restaurateur friends who were emptying their walk-ins, emptying their freezers. And it was like an episode of Top Chef. Like, I've got beef shanks and lentils and collard greens, and I got 4 hours to feed 300 people. Go. And we make these wacky meals, but these wacky meals would be delicious and hearty, and they would feed you heavily. And, you know, then the COVID lifted up. And then, okay, well, we shelved family meal. And then, you know, last year the funding fell through for some children for their school meals. And said, we said, to heck with that, too. So we started feeding the children during last summer. And, you know, come to find out, 1 in 3 children in the great city of Louisiana, great city of New Orleans, Louisiana, are food insecure. Can you imagine that? Mm. The greatest food city in all of the land, maybe the world, and our children go to bed hungry. That's unacceptable. And so we're doing our part over here with Toops Family Meal, crowdsourcing, and now we're an honest 501(c). Before, we were just being scrappy and, mm-hmm. you know, and we were a pirate ship and shooting down the hunger, but now we've gone semi-professional, and we're taking it as it comes, and we're going to feed all the children that we possibly can.
How do people get involved, Chef, if they want to donate or help out?
Well, real easy, toopsfamilymeal.com. We're also all over all the social medias, Facebook and Instagram. Real easy to reach out. If you want to donate, you can PayPal or Venmo. If you want to donate your time, every time we have a food drive, we're always looking for drivers. We're looking for people who help package the meals. So anything you can do, we can help. You can help feed the children. Anything you can, anything you will. We don't tell people no, and we take all the help we can get.
Everybody's got a story. Thank you for telling us yours. And I got to ask real quick, not to get, you know, sentimental here or anything, but do you think that there has been something that just led to a convergence of where you are now? Something guiding you, something like you said. What made me think of that is when you said Top Chef with throwing ingredients together and preparing a meal with what you had. One thing led to this, led to that, led to the other thing.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not a complicated guy.
Yeah,
I like food, and I like hanging out with the community, and I like having people over for crawfish bowls, and I just can't stand the thought of people going hungry in my house, in my city, in my restaurant. It's not going to happen. I won't sleep until it's done.
Thank you, Chef. Appreciate it. And go to Toop's Family Meal, and I'll give you more about that when we come back. 9:54, back in a flash, WWL.